The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manassero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manassero, and this is a show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes or Apple Podcast, type in Old Dog, spelled D-A-W-G, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, I'm real excited about today's show. This is great. We're talking about an area that we've talked a lot about commercial properties and commercial property investing, but this is one area we have not zeroed in on, at least until today. And we're going to be talking about triple net, NNN, right? Commercial properties. And what's it like to invest in those types of properties? And to talk about this, my guest is Joel Owens. Joel is the owner at NNN Invest. He's a principal commercial real estate broker and investor with a special emphasis on commercial retail, single net, and multi-tenant properties nationwide. He has 16 years of experience and evaluates thousands of properties a week across the country. He enjoys retail because it's more passive aspect of ownership and return versus other types of real estate. Well, Joel, welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Hey, glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I don't think you're an old dog yet, but I still think you know, for 16 years of experience, I think you've got a lot that you can share with us old dogs and that we would love to learn. But yeah, I just I'd like maybe before we get started is just to give us a little bit about your background, where you came from, and how you ended up in real estate.
Yeah, so you know, growing up, had a couple of different businesses. I used to have a car audio business when I was about 18 years old. And then later on, I got in the food industry. I worked for Domino's Pizza in all facets, including a store manager. And then I owned a restaurant at one point. The guy I worked for, Cowabunga Incorporated, was the largest franchisee in the country. From there, after I opened a restaurant, the hours that were involved with that, the money was good, but there was a lot of you were having to work for yield instead of having more passive money coming in. And so a friend of mine that owned a landscaping business, he had just sold his business and went into real estate. And I'd always wanted to try out real estate, so I got my license. And he did residential, tried residential the first few months in the business, and I didn't really care for the nights and the weekends. That's what I was trying to get away from in the restaurant business. Basically, when I was at the pizza place, one of the drivers that was older in age approached me that a developer had offered to buy his old laundromat from the 50s that he had inherited from his mother when she passed away. And I met that developer to discuss the purchase and sale contract. And when I met him, we went over everything in the contract. And once I left, the developer called me and said that normally the agents only catch 1 to 2 outs for extensions or getting the earnest money back out of the contract, and that I caught every single out, and no one had ever done that before. And then he offered for me to come work with him assembling land pieces for a 25-acre mixed-use commercial development, $150 million after build value, with 600,000 square feet of retail. And so I spent about 3 years doing that. And then after that, the economic downturn hit. This is right around 2007, 2008. There wasn't much development going on because property buyers could purchase buildings for less per square foot than they could build them. And so at that time, I went into selling larger apartment buildings. And I still do that part-time to this day. I still have a couple clients buying really large apartment buildings. But my main focus has been on commercial retail properties over the last decade or so. That encompasses about 90% of my business today.
That's great. And when you say commercial retail properties, talk to, again, just in non-real estate listeners, interests. What does that mean? Give us an example of those types of properties.
So a commercial retail property, in its most basic form, when you're looking at single tenant, that means one tenant in one building, that can be broken down into multiple different levels. So an absolute NNN lease is where you, the property owner, own the land and the building, but the tenant pays for the upkeep to the building, they pay for the property taxes, they do anything, landlord insurance, they do anything involved with that building, they take care of it. You just collect a check. It's almost like owning a stock, but you own real estate with tax benefits at the same time, and you don't have the typical fluctuations of the stock market. So you're collecting a passive check each month. Now, within the single tenant space, in addition to an absolute triple net lease, you can have what's called a double net lease or an NN lease. And that is where, depending on what's written into that lease, the landlord could have responsibility for the roof or the structure or the parking lot or the utility lines that are running underneath the parking lot. It depends on what's written into that lease. And in that situation, you still own the land and the building. And then there is a ground lease, where you own the land, but not the building as a property owner, and then the tenant pays you rent. The tenant usually constructs and pays for their own building in that situation, and you have what's called a primary lease term, which that is where, if it's 10 or 15 years on the lease, that's where the tenant is guaranteeing to pay that rent for a certain period of time before the options or renewal periods come up after the primary lease term expires. If they don't renew the option period on the ground lease at the end of the primary lease term, you, the landowner, typically get that building for free at that point. So in its basic form, those are the three types of properties for single tenant net lease properties. And then in addition to that, you have MTNL, which is multi-tenant net lease properties. And those are retail centers. So,
like a strip mall type thing?
Yeah. So in, with retail centers, you have anywhere up from a power center, which would be what a REIT or an insurance fund owns. You know, it's like a couple million square feet retail center with a Super Target and a Costco and a Lowe's and all those huge big box down to what most of my clients buy is, and what's growing the most in retail is the neighborhood street retail. So think of a retail center with internet-resistant tenants. So think of a center that's sitting outside of a subdivision in a nice, strong suburban core area with high median income and population levels. And, you know, Susie homeowner can go to the strip center at night and she can put her kids in karate and then she can go to the nail salon next door. And then after she's done with the nail salon, she can pick up the kids from the karate class and then she can go down to the end where the pizza place is and get dinner and take it home all in one location at one time, you know, for her shopping needs. And so neighborhood retail used to, before the areas were built up decades ago, malls would be the end thing. You know, you didn't have something close by, so you would have to drive 45 minutes and make it an event and find all these specialty items that you couldn't find anywhere else, because back then they didn't have that kind of stuff on the internet where you could just click a button and have all these, you know, specialty items and gadgets to deliver to your front door. You know, they didn't have that back then. So now neighborhood retail is what most of my clients are investing in. The bigger box stuff, most of my individual clients don't buy that because that's more of, you know, that's for more for a REIT. If they own, you know, 100 Lowe's and one goes dark and it takes a year to refill it, they can do things with that space, temporarily rent it out to cover property taxes and holding costs and stuff like that. And then they can portfolio average the other 99 Lowe's they own and still make money. So most of my individual investors, I kind of counsel them to stay away from those really high-priced big box stores that are 60 or 100,000 square feet in size that could take a long time to re-tenant versus the small neighborhood retail that's, you know, typically 15, 20,000 square feet and below, that typically doesn't take that long to find another tenant for if you need to.
Gotcha. And you mentioned double net, and it didn't. So what's the difference between double net and triple net?
So absolute triple net is when you don't have to do anything per the lease. You know, they cover the insurance, they cover the property taxes, any maintenance to the building, the tenant does everything. You do absolutely nothing. In a double net lease, you, the landlord, might be responsible for the roof and structure or the utility lines or the parking lot, depending on what was written into that lease when the developer developed the property and created the lease with the tenant. So you have to read each individual lease and see what it says as far as the landlord obligations. Sometimes the cap rates can be higher in that situation, but you have to be careful. For instance, if it's roof and structure, you know, how many years are left on the primary term of the lease, the roof, how many years does it have left before it needs to be replaced? Roof and parking lot can be expensive to replace those items. And so if it's going to be, you know, coming due soon where it needs to be replaced, then obviously we want to negotiate a credit from the seller before we close on the property so that that's not eating into your expected cash flow returns with these big capital expenses.
Gotcha. And for individual investors, you mentioned the you know, what you would recommend. Would that be something like a CVS or a Walgreens, you know, standalone type building?
A lot of it depends on each client's situation. So typically, the process that I have is people go to my website and they click start today and they fill out their information and then the form. Typically it's a personal financial statement. It doesn't have a bank account numbers. It doesn't have any descriptive info. It basically just has their liquidity, net worth, annual income from job or business, just to see an overall financial overview of their situation. And the reason that's important when you're looking at triple net properties, the kind of loan you can get on the property and what's available to buy and the cap rate that you could achieve depends on the price range that you're buying in. So you have an urban core area, strong suburban, weak suburban, and a rural location. Most of my clients, I have it where they buy in an urban core to a strong suburban location, and not in a weak suburban or rural location unless they live there. That's one of the exceptions I make. If they live there, know the area block by block, and they're, you know, buying single tenant, mom and pop type tenants, and they know that risk, then that's a different situation. But most of the time they're buying in urban core and strong suburban core areas. To buy in those areas, you have to be in a certain price point. And so that's why it's important that I review the potential client's financials, because when I get on a call with them to discuss their specific situation, it helps me know what range they can afford and what to talk about, you know, on the call. And different single tenant net lease properties are available in different price ranges. So the Walgreens or the CVS that you mentioned, typically in the primary lease term, they have flat rent, meaning there's no rental increases during the primary term, but sometimes in the option periods, they will have rental increases. So it depends on the individual client circumstance. If they want to own a property that is, you know, absolute triple net, they're in their retirement golden years, and they just want a passive check where they can travel the country or spend time with the grandkids and not think about anything. Tenants told us termites and don't want to think about any of that stuff, and if they're going to get the rent this month, then that kind of investment is for them. There's Dollar General stores or dollar stores. Those have flat rent as well in the primary lease term. They're a little bit cheaper in price. Those are typically about $1.5 to $2.5 million, whereas the pharmacies can be anywhere from $2.5 million in price up to, you know, they go up to $10 million. You know, but a lot of them are typically $3 or $4 million in price. Out of those two options, if a client's going to accept flat rent, I like the pharmacies because the dollar stores are sheet metal sides and back. They're in a mid-block location that's not as optimal. And if the space ever goes dark, it's going to be hard to get another tenant that's going to want to take that construction quality of that building. Versus the pharmacies are typically on a red light corner, two high traffic roads intersecting. They have large back anchors. You've got a, you know, 10 to 15,000 square foot all brick building sitting on about 1.5 to 2 acres of prime real estate. So if you're going to accept flat rent, high quality investment grade tenant, that would be the type of property I would want them to own long-term versus the dollar store.
Now, are you selling already tenanted properties, or is there, you know, some are empty, some are, you know, have tenants?
So the clients that are mainly in retirement, or some of my clients are doctors that are surgeons, or they just sold a business, or they're a business owner with a lot of capital, they're typically buying what I call stabilized assets. So these are assets with tenants that are already in place. There's a lease. And so basically something like that would look like this. So if you bought a Walgreens for $4 million and you're putting 30% down, which is $1.2 million, you would have a loan left over of $2,800,000. You would purchase, let's say, the Walgreens at maybe around a 6.0 cap rate, and then the interest rate on the loan would be about 4.0% with a 25 to 30 year amortization schedule on the repayment period, fixed for about 7 to 10 years on a commercial loan. And typically what lenders are looking for is they're looking for the borrower's net worth to be close to the loan balance, so the $2.8 million, and they're looking for their liquidity after their down payment to be at least about 10%. So in that case, the net worth would need to be around $2.8 million, and your liquidity after your $1.2 million down payment would need to be about $280,000 in that situation. And they'll count, you know, stocks and other things like that toward the liquidity number.
And are these properties where they're, you know, generally let's see, maybe close to the expiration of their lease, or they could be early renters?
Most of my clients, so typically what happens on these properties, when they're built brand new, they typically have, they used to back in the day, had a 20 or 25 year primary lease term. But what happened is there's a organization called FASB, Financial Accounting Standards Bureau, and they came out with new accounting principles that businesses had to follow and used to on their books for their responsibility or debt load, they would only have to account for the first couple of years of a lease. Well, with these recent accounting changes, now they have to count the full primary lease term, all 20 years or whatever it is. And so what that does is it makes it look like there's a lot more debt on the books for that business or obligations than there is. And so now in return, these companies now don't typically like to sign 20 or 25-year primary lease terms. They like to max do 10 or 15-year primary lease terms with options now. That's what has kind of changed too. When developers are developing these properties that are typically $5 million and under in price, they typically have a cap rate to cost, which means a break-even for the developer if they sold and made no profit. And that's typically about a 9 cap. When they sell, the developer has to pay long-term capital gains. They have to pay legal fees, and they have to pay brokerage commissions on the sale of the property. So typically that takes away 100 basis points of return for them on that property. So, you know, one basis point, 100 basis points makes up about 1% is how that works out. So if they were at a 9 cap, now their break-even after resale cost is about an 8 cap. And so what they'll do is they'll turn around and then they'll sell the property fully developed with a tenant in place for about anywhere from about a 5 to a 6 cap. So they make about 200 basis points of profit in their spread. And so when you're looking at buying these properties, you start out with a 15-year primary term lease. As the years wind down, anything with 7 years or less remaining on the primary term lease, those are very hard to get financed. The cap rate's a little bit higher, but there's less security from the tenant on the length of the primary term of the initial lease because the lenders don't count the options because the tenant may or may not renew the option period. And then you could have a dark building where you have to get it re-tenanted again. So there are some higher cap rate deals where, you know, a Walgreens, instead of being a 6 cap with 14 years left on the primary term of the lease, maybe it only has 5 years left. It's in a good location. And cap rate is, instead, it's like a 7.5 or something like that. But when you go to get debt on the property, you're not going to be able to get in with 30% down. You're going to have to put in maybe 60% down or 70% down or something like that to get the loan, because on the single tenant properties, the way that they look at the value is they'll get an appraisal done, the lenders will, and they'll ask the appraiser to do a value with the building, with the tenant and income in place, and then also what's called the dark value. And the dark value is at the end of the primary lease term, what is the property worth without a tenant and income in place, with just a dark building and the land that it sits on. And the lender wants their mortgage balance to be paid off to be less than what that dark value is. That way, if you can't re-tenant the building and the lender had to take the property back, they would be made whole in their loan in that situation. So that's why the calculation about how many years left on the primary lease term equates to whether you can get a 25 or a 30-year amortization schedule or a 10 or a 15-year amortization schedule, because they want the less the years that are remaining left on the primary lease term, the lower the amortization schedule, because they want accelerated pay down, the lenders do, on the mortgage balance.
Yeah, that's one of the areas that I think would be the biggest challenge is if you do have a tenant that leaves, what's sort of the average time period, if there is such a thing, for somebody to, in that type of property, to be able to find a new tenant?
Yeah, so it depends on what type of tenant you're talking about. So if it's a mom and pop tenant, you know, they're not part of the franchise brand, it's, you know, Joe's Tacos or something like that, and they're just looking to relocate, they can typically move the fastest and make decisions the quickest. And so from the letter of intent phase to the lease execution stage to getting all the necessary permits and build out to then opening the space, you know, and be open for business, you're probably talking maybe 3 to 4 months' time. Then when you move up to the regional tenants or multi-level unit operators or franchisees, that kind of thing, you know, typically they could take, you know, the whole process could take maybe 6 months or so. And then when you're looking at national tenants going in, those could take up to, you know, 9 months to a year to make a decision because, you know, typically Walgreens or Starbucks, they've got so many stores that they're currently re-imaging, and then they've got other stores that they're just now opening, that they have agreements in place with, that they're getting opened and operating in, and then they have their expansion plans to go into different markets or to move stores from locations in existing markets to what they consider a better location and shut those stores down. So they usually have committees, and they have to come out and look at the property, and there's a lot more red tape, and they take a lot longer to make decisions than the mom-and-pop tenants or the small to medium franchisee-type tenants. But if you have a, you know, one of my goals with my clients, you want to look at the tenant and the quality of the tenant, but you also want to look at the rent per square foot for that building going in, and you want to look at how and where it's located. The value of the dirt is what drives your long-term success. If you have a great location with high traffic counts and great visibility and great access, you know, long-term, that's where the value is going to be, because if an area only has so much land, so after it builds up, you either have to tear down old buildings or you have to readapt existing buildings to increase the density for the population levels that are growing there. And so that just makes the dirt the property is sitting on more valuable over time. So that's why I believe in well-located real estate. I'll just give you an example. So if you call up a typical broker on the seller side, they'll just try to sell you whatever that's out there. So, you know, one of my clients was looking at a Starbucks, and this broker was trying to tell them in this weak suburban area that, oh, it's a national great tenant, and, you know, it's only $1.9 million, and they got a 10-year lease, an investment great tenant, and this is an amazing property to buy it. But when you look at it, in the 10-year primary term lease, they had an early termination clause, and Starbucks went out in that weak suburban area in an economic downturn. Those are the first areas to decline and the last to recover, those rural to weak suburban areas, whereas the urban core to strong suburban, those are the ones that stay more stabilized in an economic downturn, and they're the first ones to bounce back. And so, you know, conversely, I found a property for them, Starbucks. It was only $400,000, but the national median income average is $56,000. And the income for this area was $125,000. And it was an A location versus a C minus location. And they still got the Starbucks. They spent a little bit more money, but the dirt quality was an A versus a C minus. So it's not just about the tenant. It's a lot more to do with the location as well.
Do you do a lot of like food service, or do you still, do you avoid that area? Like, you know, whatever it may be, a pizza place or hamburger place?
Yeah, so it all comes down to the client's price point. This is why I have to look at their financials in advance, because, for instance, if their price point is $2 million and below, then there's only certain single-tenant type of tenants that they can look at in that price range, because some would be out of their range. Like, for instance, you know, if you're $2 million and below, you're not going to be really looking at pharmacies, and you're not going to be really looking at sit-down restaurants like Longhorn Steakhouses and, you know, Red Lobsters and Olive Garden and Bahama Breeze and stuff like that. That's going to be, you know, out of your price range. You know, at $2 million and below, you're going to be looking at AutoZones, Advanced Auto Parts, QSRs, what we call them. They're fast food places versus sit-down. You're going to be looking at, you know, Bojangles, Taco Bell, the pizza places you have to be careful with. I used to be in that business, and a lot of the old Pizza Huts now are going dark because they used to have sit-downs for the buffets, and now 80% of their business is takeout, you know. So they're closing down those eat-in spaces because they're paying a lot of rent per square foot for something that only drives maybe 15% of their business sales. And so it's dead space. So they're going more to inline retail centers or freestanding buildings, but they have like a, you know, a drive-through component and it's less square footage on the inside. So you have to know how to evaluate these different types of properties. And then there's what I call my five levels of risk. So the way that I give the easiest example to explain would be, you know, Yum Brands that owns Taco Bell and Kentucky Fried Chicken. An example of the most security on a lease would be Yum Brands parent corp guarantee over 20,000 locations is backing that store where you're purchasing that single tenant net lease property and they're paying you the rent every month for that lease in place. The guarantor is the parent corporation. That's the strongest guarantee that you can get. Below that would be is what we call a subsidiary of the parent corporation, where maybe, you know, 20 of the states and 6,000 stores is backing it instead of the 20,000 locations. Then below that would be a large franchisee in the Yum Brand organization that maybe owns 100 Taco Bells or 140 Taco Bells, and they've been in a, you know, industry 10 or 20 years, and they're well established, and they're backing all their stores. Then below that would be a small franchisee that only owns maybe one, two, three locations, and they're newer to the system, and they're not that well established yet, and their net worth isn't as strong as the larger franchisee operator. And then below that would be not even a Yum Brand, you know, Taco Bell or KFC, not even a national brand, you know, no franchise agreement, no royalty fee advertising backing them, no training systems, and be, you know, Joe's Taco that just opened up down the street that some local independent, you know, dive that's local to that area, you know, that would be the least level of guarantee, you know, out there and the most risk.
This concludes part one of this podcast series. Stay tuned for the exciting conclusion this coming Monday.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.